Thank you. It is a pleasure for me to again address this illustrious group. I interpret the fact that I'm invited back every semester to mean that at least Harold enjoys the talks. I don't know if anyone else does.
There are other interpretations.
So the topic of this faculty forum is the Inquisition in Mexico. What I'm going to do is give you a little bit of background about the Spanish Inquisition, and then focus on two unusual characters who lived in Mexico and who ran awry of the Inquisition. So first of all, a little background about the Inquisition. In the middle of the 12th century, fanatical Almohad Muslims overran southern Spain. First, we have to understand that the Jews lived in the 10th, 11th centuries, good chunk of the 12th century, in harmony with the Muslims who controlled Spain. In fact, it's called the Golden Age of Judaism, and much Jewish scholarship, as well as much Arabic scholarship, much Muslim scholarship was accomplished during this period. But a fanatical group overran southern Spain, and it caused a massive Jewish exodus to the Christian north. And at first, the Christians proved to be as tolerant to the Jews as were the Muslim rulers of during the Golden Age. However, as the 13th century progressed, things began to deteriorate. In particular, in the 1300s, the situation worsened drastically. The Black Death struck Spain. Of course, who was responsible for the Black Death? Obviously, the Jews. You know the story of the old Jew who's sitting on a bench reading the newspaper from Farrakhan's group, and the fellow says to him, "How can you read it? He's so anti-Semitic. He has such bad things to say about this guy." "What are you talking about?" he says. "I read this paper. The Jews control this. The Jews control that. They're in charge of everything. Of course I want to read this paper." So the Jews were traditionally blamed for all sorts of things. And in response to this disaster, both Christian religious consciousness and open anti-Semitism increased. In June of 1391, riots broke out in Seville. They spread through the country. They went on for several months. And at the end of that time, 50,000 Jews had been killed, murdered, and numerous ancient Jewish communities had been completely destroyed. During the riots, Jews were offered the following choice: either convert or die. And sadly, for the first time in Jewish history, masses of Jews chose to convert. Why exactly this was different than in other places is an interesting question, which I don't think anybody can completely answer, but nonetheless, there was mass conversion. In 1411, a priest, Vincent Ferrari, later to become St. Vincent, embarked on a major mission to secure even more Jewish converts. Estimates put the number of Jews who converted during these two great waves, 1391 and 1412, as high as 400,000. There was a widespread feeling amongst the Jews that the conversion really didn't mean anything, and eventually they'd be able to go back to practicing Judaism.
That was also done for the
Arabs. Yes, 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 absolutely, absolutely. But this was not to be the case. A shocking phenomenon occurred in Spain, namely the conversion to Christianity of prominent Jewish scholars. The most infamous of these was the rabbi of Burgos, Solomon Halevi, who became Pablo de Santa Maria. He rose in position, became bishop in the Catholic Church, and he persecuted Jews with great zeal. He played a major role in enacting various decrees and degraded unconverted Jews. Jews were forced to wear coarse sackcloth, in which there was a badge that was of shame that was sewn. He wouldn't let Jews trim their beards. He made their life miserable. The converts had a dilemma. Once the various pogroms and the various pressures to convert abated, they thought that they would be able to resume their Judaism. But the Pope ruled that any Jew, unless he or she had been absolutely forced and had protested while being forced to convert, could not return to Judaism. these converts were considered by the Catholic Church as real Christians, and to go back to and practice the Jewish religion was considered a capital offense. It was not to happen, not to happen. There then grew up a group of Jews who, while outwardly appeared as Christians, secretly practiced certain Jewish practices. They're known as Maranos, Anusim, Conversos. Different, Marano is a word that people say means pig. Anusim, Anus is somebody who's forced. The Conversos are converts, but they're not real converts. They were not trusted by the real Christians, and they were not trusted by the Jews. They were not trusted by the Jews. Very quickly, certain Jewish practices fell into, could not be practiced. For example, to circumcise one's child, if one was supposedly Christian, was essentially to commit that child to death, because that was something punishable by death. And by 1492, the third generation of conversos were overwhelmingly Christian with lingering traces of Judaism. Faithful Jews attempted to bring conversos back to Torah, now to Judaism. They have to understand something. There was a group of Jews who had resisted all attempts to convert them, and they remained Jews in Spain. They remained Jews in Spain. And they did their best to try to encourage observance of Judaism on the part of those who had converted. And the Catholic Church realized that this group of Jews were a problem for them because they were a negative influence as far as they were concerned. And therefore, Ferdinand, who was then king of Spain, issued an edict expelling all Jews from Spain in 1492. Interesting date, of course, 1492, because it's related to the founding of the New World, the discovery of the New World. What did they do, though, before and even after the Jews were expelled? After all, there were these group of people who were ostensibly Christian. They went to Mass, perhaps. They had Christian names, but they secretly practiced Jewish customs. Something called the Inquisition was set up. Now, the Inquisition was only for those who had converted or whose parents or grandparents had converted. It was not for those Jews who were still living in Spain until 1492. And the object of the Inquisition was to ferret out people who were secretly practicing Judaism. And the Inquisition used a wide variety of tortures. You were never told what you were accused of. It was a convenient way. The church, by the way, if you were convicted, the church then confiscated your property. And it was a very convenient way of getting wealth. If A, who was not a Jew, was in competition business-wise with somebody who was a converso, and he didn't like the competition, he would go and he would claim that, that the other person was secretly practicing Judaism, was doing this, this, and this, and this. And the problems were tremendous for those who were secret Jews. Tremendous. The Jews left in 1492. The actual edict was signed in March 31st, 1492. The Jews left Spain on a day called Tisha B'Av. That is the saddest day in the Jewish calendar. It is the day on which the first temple and the second temple were both destroyed in Jerusalem. And this has been a day of tragedy throughout Jewish history. And thousands, exactly how many, we don't know. 100,000, 150,000, maybe 200,000, maybe even more, left Spain. Where did they go? Well, a number of them went to Morocco, they went to Turkey, they went to various places, but a chunk of them, a large chunk of them, went to Portugal. And they were welcomed in Portugal. They were welcomed in Portugal because the king needed their abilities. After all, let's understand something, ladies and gentlemen. The ability to read and write was universal amongst Jewish males, virtually universal. This was not the case, certainly, in the rest of society. Jews had been involved in trade because most of the other professions had been closed to them. And so they were valuable people and they had resources. And the king of Portugal at the time in 1492 welcomed the Jews because he realized that they were going to be a valuable asset for him. 630 wealthy families were allowed permanent residence in Portugal by paying a rather large sum of money. The rest of the Jews were allowed to stay. They had to pay a head tax, which was much less, and they were told that after 6 months, boats would be provided for them to leave. That never happened. The king made sure that very few Jews could escape from Portugal. And in fact, later on, and a few years later, in 1497, the new king of Portugal wanted to marry in either one of his relatives himself to the royal family of Spain. The royal family of Spain said, there is no way that we will allow one of the members of our family to marry into a country that has Jews. You have to get rid of the Jews. So what did they then do? All the Jews in Portugal were forcibly converted. They were literally dragged to the font. Water was sprinkled on them, and they were instantly made Catholics. So those who had resisted in Spain now found themselves in the position of being Christians, whether they liked it or not. Life for them was also difficult. They were despised by the quote-unquote real Christians. They secretly practiced Judaism to as much as they could. And they sought to get out of Portugal, but that was not easy. In 1492, as we know, Columbus discovered America. He discovered the New World. I don't know if you're aware. I don't believe Columbus was a Jew. There are those who want to make him a Jew. I don't think he was a Jew at all. There's a book by the name of Rabbi Kaiserling that he writes about the Jews that assisted Columbus. There were many Jews because Columbus used various astronomical charts and things that had been prepared by Jews, and they were actually Jews who were on his boat. His interpreter was Louis de Torres. His ship physician was a Jew. His ship surgeon was a Jew. But I don't believe Columbus was a Jew. But there were Jews on the first voyage and Jews on later voyages. October 12, 1492, by the way, that's according to the Julian calendar. It's not October 12, 1492, according to the calendar that we have today. That's really Columbus Day. That's when the New World was discovered. That happens to be a day also. It was a day in the Jewish calendar, what's called Hoshana Rabbah, which is a certain special festival in Judaism. In any case, Jews looked to the New World now as a hope. There were economic opportunities. Many people looked to the New World because it had economic opportunities. And they hoped that they would be able to earn a very good living there, and many did. But in addition to that, the Jews wanted to get out from under the Inquisition. And they felt that in the New World, the Inquisition would not follow them. So a number of Jews emigrated to Brazil and to Mexico. However, the Inquisition did follow them. It really did follow them to the New World. And it wasn't long before the Inquisition was quite active in Mexico. And we're going to talk about two people who were persecuted by the Inquisition. And we'll see the really unbelievable level of commitment that people who had really no Jewish background had for Judaism. The first person we're going to talk about is Luis Carvajal. Carvajal Jr. He was born in Benavente, Portugal. By the way, Benavente, Portugal, even to this day, is a place where Jews secretly practice Judaism, interestingly enough. He was baptized by the Bishop of Benavente. His early education consisted of studying, reading, writing, and basic mathematics. Later, he attended a Jesuit school for 3 years where he was taught Latin and rhetoric. The fact that he knew Latin is going to be crucial in the story. Crucial. His father, Francisco Rodriguez, was a Marano. A secret Jew influenced his wife and most of his 9 children to live as crypto-Jews. In 1584, Louis and his family immigrated to Mexico with his uncle. This uncle, who became the governor of the new kingdom of Leon in Mexico, had no sympathy at all for Jews, even though he was of Jewish background. Louis's father died not long after they came to Mexico. Louis succeeded him as head of the family, and he spent a chunk of his time exploring the northern territories of Mexico with his uncle. And on these journeys, he sought out wherever he could crypto-Jews who could teach him about Jewish practices. He was very interested. Eventually, he was able to purchase a Bible in Latin. And that began to open up worlds for him. He began to read what many people would call the Old Testament, and he studied it. He studied it. And his drive to become an observant Jew is clearly evidenced in his description of how, after his father's passing, he circumcised himself in a ravine in Mexico. He wrote the following. Now, careful, Steve, I know this is. When the Lord took my father away from this life, I returned to Panuco, where a clergyman sold me a sacred Bible for 6 pesos. I studied it constantly and learned much while alone in the wilderness. I came to know many of the divine mysteries. One day I read chapter 17 of Genesis, in which the Lord ordered Abraham, our father, to be circumcised. Especially those words which say that the soul of him who will not be circumcised will be erased from among the book of the living. I became so frightened that I immediately proceeded to carry out the divine command. Prompted by the Almighty and his good angel, I left the corridor of the house where I had been reading, leaving behind the sacred Bible, took some old worn scissors, and went over to the ravine of the Panuco River. There, with longing and a vivid wish to be inscribed in the book of the living, something that could not happen without this holy sacrament, I sealed it by cutting off almost all of the prepuce and leaving very little of it. This is translated from the writings of Louis de Carvajal by Seymour Lieberman. Louis and some of the members of his family became the focal point of a network of crypto-Jews based in Mexico City. The man clearly was willing to sacrifice virtually everything for Judaism. He and some of his siblings encouraged former Jews to return to Judaism. Through their efforts, Jews were circumcised, they studied the Bible, and observed festivals. It was only a matter of time before his Judaizing would come to the attention of the Catholic officials. And indeed it did. A warrant was issued for his arrest on April 20th, 1589. He was found hiding in his mother's house on May 9th. He was questioned over several months and accused of Judaizing. What were the accusations? Apparent, his father had asked him while he, the father, lay dying to wash the body as is customary in the Jewish religion, and he had done it. Louis had studied the Old Testament and the prophets in order to be more knowledgeable in his practice of Judaism. He quoted the prophets habitually, and it was impossible to convince him that the prophets had predicted that Jesus Christ would come as the Messiah. He had run away to Veracruz when his sister, Isabel de Andrada, was imprisoned by the Holy Office, and finally that he had protected Judaizers by not denouncing them. He denied everything. He claimed that he wasn't a secret Jew. He claimed he didn't practice Judaism, but he was threatened with being tortured. So finally, in August of 1589, seeing apparently that there was no way out, he confessed. He went down on his knees. He kissed the floor. He shed tears. He beat his breast and said, "I have sinned. Mercy, mercy." So following the usual procedures of the tribunal, on February 24th, 1590, Louis was permitted to be reconciled to the Catholic faith in an auto da fe. After public abjuration of his errors, he was condemned to wear the penitential cloak, that's a funny-looking garment, what's called sanbenito, and to perpetual imprisonment. And here he is, he's imprisoned for life. However, there was a problem. There was no prison in Mexico at the time to keep prisoners forever. So what to do with him? So he was transferred to the St. Hippolyto Mater, a convalescent home in Mexico City, where he was required to perform any services that the hospital administrator would require of him. He spent 2 years in the hospital doing all sorts of menial labor, completely isolated from his family. Louis's mother and his four sisters had also been convicted by the Inquisition. They had also confessed at the same auto de fe, and they were living, they were confined to live in a little home, an isolated home near the College of the Holy Cross in Mexico City. In 1592, one of Lewis's brothers-in-law, for a nice bribe, one could get a lot of things done, was able to bribe, he petitioned the church and was able to bribe the officials to allow Lewis to live with his mother and his sisters so that they would not be without some sort of male protection. And indeed, he began to live with them. He found his mother and his sisters completely overcome by their experiences with the Inquisition, but it was not long before he persuaded them to again practice Jewish rites. Lewis developed a relationship with a Father Pedro de Ores. He was the superior of the College of the Holy Cross. As a result, the friar made him his secretary, had him teach certain classes in the college, and gave him the key to the library. And this opened up an entire world for Lewis. Because during the day when the students were in and out, he couldn't do what he wanted to, but he began staying late, and he began scouring the library for books. He came across a copy of Josephus' History of the Jews, which he consumed in his interest, read. And he also found many other texts dealing with the Bible, dealing with Judaism. And he came across something which astounded him. These were the 13 fundamental principles of Judaism that Maimonides had laid down. These were virtually unheard of in Spanish and Portuguese countries. Unheard of. The net result was that Lewis became a rather well-educated Jew. He knew much more than he certainly had known years before. He was finally released again for bribes from imprisonment, and but he remained free for only 3 months. Only 3 months. He was then arrested again. Witnesses testified against him that he indeed was practicing Judaism, which he was. This time he realized there was no way out. With the Inquisition, the second time, it's over. Second time it's over. What does over mean, by the way, ladies and gentlemen? What does over mean? Over means death, but you have to understand, the Catholic Church never technically killed anyone. The Catholic Church never sheds blood. All of the tortures that were employed during the Inquisition, none of them shed blood. None of them. When somebody was to be executed, they were turned over to the secular authorities who did the execution. The church technically never killed anyone. What was the method of death? Well, one could be burned alive at the stake. Not a pleasant way to go. However, there was another possibility. If in the end you reconciled with the church and said that you believed in Catholicism, then you would be what's called garroted. What does garroted mean? It means that you stand up against a rather large pole, a wire is put around your neck and around the pole, and it is slowly turned until you suffocate, till you die by strangulation. That's preferable to being burned alive. Preferable, it really is. It's preferable to being burned alive, and many, many people took that option in the end. Many, many of these Muranos took that option in the end. Anyway, he realized that he had no choice. He admitted openly that he believed in Judaism. There was no way that they could convince him. In fact, they had trouble dealing with him because now he knew more than many of them. He knew much more than many of the priests, and he was a real problem. He was imprisoned and tortured for nearly 2 years, and finally on December 8, 1596, he was burned at the stake in Mexico City. He was burned with his mother, Francisca, and three of his sisters, Isabel, Leonor, and Catalina. No Jewish woman had been burned at the stake in Spain before that. That was the first time. That was the first time. Before his body was consumed in the flames, a priest claimed that he had been garroted. But others claim, no, others claim that he actually allowed himself to be burned alive. His sister Anika, he was survived by a sister and a disciple, Judah Justa Mendez, and two of his brothers escaped to Europe. That was the end of Lewis Carver Hull. Interestingly enough, I get an invitation. Let me back up and say, the internet is alive as far as I'm concerned. What do I mean by that? You put something up there, and you never know who will find it by searching and who will then write to you. And this has happened to me time and time again. I got an invitation. There's a conference, I think at the University of Texas in April, in honor of the Carver Halls, the whole celebrating, inviting me to attend. Unfortunately, it's during Passover, so I simply can't go. But nonetheless, the memory of this fellow and his family is still alive. We'll now talk about a second fellow, a gentleman named of Thomas Sobremonte. He's a century later. So what we just talked about is what happened in the 16th century. The Inquisition certainly continued well into the 17th century. In fact, Jews were brought up in front of the Inquisition and were actually burned at the stake as late as into the latter part of the 18th century in Portugal. By the way, if they caught you, then they punished you. If they couldn't catch you, let's suppose you had died before they came after you. They would exhume the body and burn it. They would exhume the body and burn it. That's how far they went. And if you escaped, then any time you went back into any territory that was controlled by the Inquisition, you were in danger, life and death danger. And again, part of the whole thing was the first time they confiscated your property. Many Jews were told that they had to leave Mexico, but since they had taken all their money, there was no way for them to leave Mexico. It was a catch-22. Anyway, Thomas Sobremonte. Thomas Sobremonte was born in 1592 in the town of Medina de Riosca in Castile, Spain. His mother was imprisoned by the Holy Office and died there. His ancestors on his father's side had been old Christians and noblemen. Old Christians mean that they didn't have, quote-unquote, any Jewish blood in the family. Thomas was baptized at birth and confirmed at the age of 7 or 8. Sobremonte could correctly recite the Paternoster and other Catholic prayers. He knew how to read and write in his own language and in Latin because he had attended the College of the Jesuits in Valencia, Spain, for 1 year and had studied canonical law at the University of Salamanca. By the way, 1592, it's 100 years after the Jews have left Spain. What sort of Jewish education could there have been? It's interesting that most of the tradition in the Murano community was transmitted by the women primarily. It was the women who kept it alive. It was the women who remembered smatterings of prayers. When he was 14 years of age, and by the way, this is something that was typical in the Murano community, they did not tell the young children that they were Jews. They waited until they were at least 12, 13, or 14, because they felt to tell a young child that they were Jewish could easily, the child wouldn't understand, would blurt it out. At 14, his mother told him that he was Jewish, and that Jews practice a religion that's not Christianity, and that the way for him is to follow the Jewish faith. His mother instructed him to keep his Judaism secret in order not to endanger their lives. She taught him several prayers, but did not allow him to write them down. One of these prayers, which he was able to recite in broken Hebrew, was, well, he said, Sema Hashem Baruto Seulan Banal, which is supposedly Shema. By the way, what is the source for what I told you about Lewis and for this fellow? The church kept rather detailed, copious records. We have the records of these trials. They're available, and people went through them, and they transcribed them, and they wrote about them. So he knew something about Judaism. But the Judaism he practiced certainly was not what Judaism really is. His mother had owned a notebook that had seven penitential psalms, including psalms in her own handwriting on the day before Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Atonement in the Jewish religion, a day of fasting. The whole family assembled, they took baths, they put on fresh linen, and they ate fish. The same evening, they all prayed together while standing until 2 a.m. They fasted the night and the day. and then they broke their fast by dining on fish meal. Now, one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that Judaism is based on a calendar that is part lunar and part solar. And as a result, in order to know when a festival comes out, you need access to a calendar. And it's not simple in the sense that, for example, this year is a leap year in the Jewish calendar. What is a leap year? Well, first of all, simply a month, simply the time, the length of a month is between the seeing of the new moon and then the seeing the second time of the new moon. But that's 29 days, 13 hours, I think, and something seconds, okay? So a Jewish month can be either 29 days or 30 days. And they alternate. They alternate. But if you take 29 six times and 30 six times, you do not get 365 days. So what happens is that the Jewish calendar, which is that lunar part, is falling behind the solar year. But Passover must be in the springtime. That's in the Bible. Passover is the festival in the springtime. So the Jewish calendar adjusts for that by putting in a certain number of leap years, 7 leap years in every 19. And a leap year means you throw in an extra month. So that's one of the reasons why, by the way, I'm sure you noticed that Easter and Passover are quite out of phase. In fact, somebody sent me an interesting article about how you calculate Easter. It's quite complicated, it turns out to be. Not so simple, but that's why Passover is coming later than this year, than Easter. Oftentimes they coincide. In any case, without a Jewish calendar, you don't know when Yom Kippur is, you don't know when Passover is, you don't know when anything is. And that's a real problem. So they did their best. They did their best. Thomas was appointed a page in the Don Rodrigo Enriquez de Mendoza of Don Rodriguez and Don Rodrigo Enriquez. It's interesting. Somebody asked me today if I spoke Spanish, and I told them I certainly didn't. And I guess that's quite clear because I can barely read these things. Anyway, and one day, another page in the same service accused him of being a Jew, and in anger, Sobremonte actually killed the fellow. Because of this, he went into hiding in a neighboring convent and changed his name. In the year 1612, he sailed to Mexico and settled as a trader there. Because he felt that he was away from the Inquisition. He would be able to keep away from the Inquisition. But he was arrested by the Inquisition for the first time in March 1st, 1624, and removed to Mexico City in November of 1624. During his hearings, he eventually revealed his Jewish background and religious practices. So Vermente told the court that he relented of having followed his mother's instructions and was willing to return to Catholicism. This apparently was their approach the first time around. Admit that, first deny, then admit and say you're sorry and you'll never do it again, and hopefully they'll leave you alone. Hopefully. Although some demanded capital punishment, they condemned him to appear in auto-de-fe, to be reconciled, and to wear the penitential garment. He was also sentenced to serve 1 year in prison and to the confiscation of all his belongings. Also, he was required to assist every Sunday and on holy days at the High Mass and to attend sermons of the convent of the Dominican friars. However, if the Inquisition thought that they had cured him of his practice of Judaism, they were sadly mistaken. Sadly mistaken. While in prison, he asked to share a cell with a fellow who he knew was also a Marrano. And while in prison, he had that fellow circumcised him. While in prison. They were both of his cellmate and himself were both subsequently released and they resumed their practice of Judaism. They did whatever they could to assist other Marranos, and the following story illustrates how far they went. So Bramante had a difference of opinion with this other fellow about when Yom Kippur was. Again, the calendar is, they didn't have a Jewish calendar. The other fellow claimed it was a certain day, and Sobramenti claimed it was 7 days later. What to do? What did Sobramenti do? He and his family fasted for 7 days. Now, whether they drank something in the evening or whatever, I cannot tell you, but they actually fasted the entire period to be sure that they had observed Yom Kippur. It's quite unbelievable. He was again on June 20th, 1629, denounced by the inquisitors, by the attorney general, because he was seen horseback riding. See, because he was he had been convicted, there were certain things he was not allowed to do. His life was highly restricted. He had been seen riding on horseback, publicly bearing arms, dressed in silk and fine clothes, conduct that was forbidden to those who had reconciled with the church. Several witnesses confirmed the denunciation. Despite all this, Sobramenti was not imprisoned because for a bribe, paying a fine, he was able to get rid of those who had accused him. The accusation seemed to disappear. He was then left in peace by the Inquisition until 1644. In that year, the Attorney General denounced him on the grounds that since his reconciliation with the church in 1625, he had been practicing Judaism, which he had. Many witnesses claimed that he had celebrated his marriage to his wife in accordance with Jewish tradition, that he and his family kept the Jewish dietary laws and only ate kosher food, that he covered his head with a cap when he recited the Psalms in Latin, that the crypto-Jewish community in Mexico considered him to be a rabbi, that he prayed 3 times a day as is required by Jewish tradition, his head covered with a cap which was tied to a towel because he was constantly washing his hands. They had strange practices, pieces of Judaism. Furthermore, he and his family were accused of attending Mass and making confession only to deceive their neighbors and authorities. Also, that church attendance was always preceded by fasting at home and asking God to forgive them for this quote-unquote sin. During his second trial, Sobramenti steadfastly denied everything that he was accused of. In addition, he did not denounce anybody. The trial continued for 5 years. 5 years. One can only imagine the horrors that he experienced under the questioning of his inquisitors. He often fasted during this period and became emaciated. February 21st, 1649, Sobramenti was condemned to capital punishment and sentenced to be burned alive at the stake on April 11th, 1649 in auto de fe. Still, the church wasn't finished with him. Couldn't even let him die in peace. All efforts, all stops were pulled out to try to get him to reconcile with Catholicism before he was to be executed. Clergymen visited him, they argued with him, they talked with him. Finally, he said to them, "Do not exert yourself, don't try to convince me, for I must die as a Jew. It would be better to convert yourself to Judaism." That's what he told them. At one point, due to the fact that Sobramenti had uttered blasphemies, this is now during the auto de fe. By the way, these were huge public spectacles. There is a square still. I have a friend who's from Mexico City. He told me there's still a place in Mexico City which has the name that where it was taken. There were huge public spectacles that went on for hours, and the masses came, and this was entertainment. Don't forget, there was no television, no anything. This was the entertainment of the day. And during the whole thing, because he had denied Catholicism, first he was gagged, then he was not gagged. When his mother-in-law, Leonor Gomez Nunez, his daughter, her daughter Maria Gomez, that's Sobramenti's wife, and her other daughter, Anna Gomez, all condemned to death, appeared on the stage. There was a big stage. Sobramenti, obviously not gagged at this time, said, "Remember the mother of the Maccabeans." He urged them not to give in. Not to give in. When his sentence was read, he said that he believed only in the God of Israel. All attempts to get him to acknowledge Catholicism failed, despite the fact that such an action would have meant that he would have been first strangled. Again, that was better than being burned. 13 others who were executed on this same day chose to be garroted before they were burned, but not Sobramenti. He was actually burned alive at the stake. His commitment to Judaism obviously knew no bounds. It really is amazing to me how people who had so little knowledge of what Judaism really was, because they had little smatterings, Judaism, the practice of Judaism is not simple. It's complex, I'll be honest with you. It's a life that's different in many ways than the life of the rest of the world. Religious practices require a certain knowledge of things. They require certainly knowledge of Hebrew. They require a whole background, okay? And I don't know why it stopped, but it did. Okay, so it stopped. And yet these people who had such little knowledge, such tenuous attachments, were willing to risk everything. It simply amazes me. Thank you.
When the Jews fled Spain, you pointed out